Welcome to the GMS Magazine podcast, episode 434, a podcast about the people who make and the people who play tabletop board games and role-playing games. I am Paco Garcia, your host, and this is the RPG Interview Room, the show in which I am lucky enough to get together with some of the best people in the world of role-playing game and ask them lots of questions about their work. In this episode, I am joined by Jackie Leung. Jackie is a Chinese-American tabletop RPG writer and designer, and he's also the lead creative director for Unbreakable Publishers, a platform bringing Asian-owned voices stories into tabletop spaces. I wanted to interview Jackie because I have seen one of their recent productions, which basically it's called Unbreakable Revolution, which is a collection of Asian-centric adventures that showcases the versatility of Asian stories with a plethora of tabletop role-playing systems and rule sets. Now, I have to say, I did order it from DriveThruRPG a while ago, and I still haven't received my copy, which is gutting, because I've taken a look at the PDF. I have not read it because I find reading PDFs really, really hard, but it looks and feels amazing, and I am gagging to bury my nose into that beautiful, beautiful book. But meanwhile, I just wanted to talk to Jackie about it, because it's I think it's a very important project and a very, very interesting one indeed. If you would like to participate or sponsor this podcast, or if you would like to send us your questions or comments, please do get in touch. You can email me on podcast@gmsmagazine.com or find me in Twitter. I am at GMS Magazine. And by all means, do join us in Facebook or our Discord server. There's a link in the show notes, and I would love to see you there. And please, do leave a review of the podcast in whatever platform you happen to listen. It helps a lot, and it means even more to me and the rest of the team. And now, well, here's Jackie. Jackie, welcome to the show. First time I have you here, which is absolutely wonderful to have you around, because you have curated an absolutely amazing product with Unbreakable Revolution. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm really looking forward to it.
me too, because we've been trying for a bit and swapping emails here and there for the last, I don't know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks now.
Yeah, something like that.
Very, very, very long. Time zones make life difficult. Damn.
But they sure do.
Anyway, before we start with your products and what you have done, who are you?
Who am I?
Yeah, I mean, why are you even here? Stupid question.
Well, I will say for the capacity of Unbreakable, I am the creative lead manager for Unbreakable Publishers, which is a platform that we have developed to try to elevate Asian creators and Asian voices in the TTRPG space. That is our main objective and our main goal. And so we want to invite Asian creators to either experienced or no experience to get the opportunities to learn about the TTRPG industry through creating and through actually, you know, getting a published work as a result of it. And then that way, we're working towards trying to make it into a space where we can try to mentor each other or help each other find opportunities so that we can try to bring more Asian voices in a space that sometimes gets very shunted.
How did you start within the TTRPG world, though? Because with Unbreakable is a fairly recent thing, but you've been at it for quite some time. What is your background?
So my background, I started coming into the TTRPG space actually as a blogger way back in 2014. So I was a blogger then, and I predominantly just focused on Dungeons and Dragons and a couple of other RPGs that I liked at the time. And around 2017, I took my first steps to try to be a TTRPG creator and a writer. And then over the years, I've had a lot of opportunity. I had some wonderful opportunities to work with other big projects, like the Uncaged Anthology. And I've had the opportunity to, I did have one writing credit for Paizo for Lost Omens, for Gods and Magic, and that's where I got most of my start.
Okay, you were described to me by Smooks Chang as the most prolific blogger in Asia.
So, I will say it was definitely I could see that, because a lot there are still a lot of people who still remember me from my blogging days. I still get asked about that quite a bit, actually.
Are you still active as a blogger, or how is that something that you have parked?
I think now I don't blog as much as I used to. Especially the last 2 years, especially 2019, I have been very focused on Unbreakable and being a freelance writer. But it is something that I still occasionally used to do on my Patreon, except for right now. But for the most part, yeah, I still like blogging. I still miss blogging, actually. I just wish I had more time, because my process for writing a blog article takes like an average of like 2 weeks.
Okay, fair enough. No, I mean, that's fair enough. I mean, since I've been having the blog myself, it does take some time to think about what you're going to write it and then edit it and then think about publishing. And publishing, it takes longer than people think, actually.
Yeah, I used to have a 6 to 8 month content schedule. I would write those every year starting in October. I would start writing out the content schedule for the following year and start planning, and then have enough space to adjust where I need to. And things like that.
Because at
my busiest, I used to churn out five articles a week, every week, for about 6 months straight.
That is unbelievable. I mean, that is a lot of content. You can write a lot of novels in that time.
I did. I actually wrote the manuscript of a novel at that time, too.
What made you take the leap from being a evidently successful and prolific blogger to wanting to make a living writing RPGs?
I think I wanted to try for a career change. That was part of it. And then I saw at that time when I started making that change, I started seeing more about the growing opportunities in like community content programs, especially like the DMs Guild. And then eventually I started seeing other opportunities coming in from those kinds of spaces and seeing that I can self-publish. And that was I figured that would be a wonderful opportunity to get my feet wet and try and learn about the process. And over time, I think the best way I could put it was I ended up in places that gave me better opportunities as it went along.
Right. How was it jumping? I mean, what was it rewarding? What kind of experience was it?
So I will say I am the outlier for a first time creator, because the usual most common advice people will give for creating for anything creating wise is that the first thing you ever create is never going to be great. Mm-hmm. And it may not even be successful. And I unfortunately broke that mold by having my very first content be a very strong bestseller in a matter of a month.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's setting the benchmark very, very high.
And I kind of, it still does well. So it was something I didn't expect. And I think that changed a lot of my outlook for the process, and I learned a lot since then, and I've learned a lot about the actual the work involved for that whole process and what it would take to achieve that.
What was the reception of you as a writer? And with that, I'm going to very directly go for the fact that you're Asian, and there are very few Asian writers within the RPG community. We are seeing a few more here and there, but there have been traditionally very, very few. What was the reception that you saw when you started?
I think when I first started, I think because I'm also masculine presenting, I don't think I had as much adversity up front. And so I will say, for the most part, the experience was pretty neutral, I would say, for my early experience. I think because at that time the space was, because it was so new and the TTRPG space was starting to enter, like at least the hobby is entering into a mainstream lens. And so people didn't really know how to react to new people coming in or how they wanted to react. And then now that things are kind of solidified now it feel there's always that element of like, to me, it always feels like there's this little bit of like gatekeeping element still.
Okay.
But whereas before there was just enough room where I could wiggle my way in. And maybe that's why I got there.
How does that gatekeeping manifest? What do you see that makes you think, I have a hurdle here?
I will say probably for me, the gatekeeping felt the most affluent when people were talking about the longevity of the game and whether or not this was just like a fad. And then when people start coming in, telling their own stories and trying to get into the space, they felt like there's no need for these kinds of stories. That's usually what I felt, was there's no need for these stories. It's like, okay, well, I'm still going to tell it.
I just think that there is no need for these stories. Such a ridiculously weak excuse for not letting other people tell their stories, you know. Oh, I don't need it, so nobody else does. What the hell? That's completely ridiculous. Does that still happen to you, or have you seen in the last few years that things have changed for the better? What is it like compared to what we used to be when you started?
I think when we compared to then, now there are more people aware of the fact that there are stories that are not being told and that there are perspectives that have not been really analyzed or assessed or looked at before. And I feel like people are more receptive to it. They're more willing to look at it at the very least. And I think the important thing too is that people, not only are they receptive and understand and willing to take it and accept these sort of stories now, but the fact that they're able to understand it and that it's in a form that they can understand as well. Because I think the other big thing too is that when you want to tell a story, sometimes you tell it in your own way, but you may not tell it in a way that's relatable or enough for somebody else to understand you. And so I think that's also taken some change as well of how we told our stories.
And how do you tell them actually? What would you say are the main differences in the way that you're telling your stories and the way that have traditionally been told or that are traditionally published?
I think so. The best example that what sparked a lot of the controversy for at least for Asian stories has been for example about like how Oriental Adventures was used to portray specifically East Asian cultures, and how. Basically, when you really take a deep look at it, it just felt like there was no nuance, and that any nuance that was there just kind of got garbled up in these kind of appropriative measures that were put into the writing. And, you know, we can look in hindsight and say that, well, because they didn't have access to all the same kinds of information that we have now, sure. And we can say that, you know, publication, the way publishing was done then was different, sure. But it doesn't excuse the fact that it happened and that, you know, we have to do better about it. And I think that's the important part, is we want to do better. And there are people who just don't feel like it's necessary.
Which is, yeah, again, I still think that's a ridiculous lane, because one of the things when I have taken a look at how, you know, Asian stories are told and Western stories are told, I see a massive difference between the traditional monomyth, you know, the hero's mm-hmm. journey, which is incredibly prevalent. Even when people don't realize they're doing it, they actually are doing it because it's so, so mm-hmm. common. From the different kind of dynamics that are present within Asian stories, you know, there's a lot more about group dynamics and the people who travel with the so-called hero, who is more often than not a non-hero that becomes something else, not necessarily a hero either. So have you implemented many differences from traditional background, from traditional stories into your storytelling?
I will say personally for me, it is something I still continue to work towards, because I am born and raised in the United States, so I have a lot of Western influences in my upbringing. But I am also a first generation American, so I actually have the fortunate of being very closely related to my culture from my parents and my grandparents, my great grandparents. And so I have the diaspora I experience is unique to me. And in this, and I will say that for me personally, I have been working towards adding more of the methods of storytelling that a lot, especially for me, since I identify as Chinese, a lot of like Chinese stories, how they tell their stories and how the central themes that they try to have and try to incorporate those kinds of things into my games and my stories as well.
To those people who say that these kind of stories are not needed, what is your reply to that, other than, you know, the one that I would give them, which ends in off? What's your reply to those people?
I always say that, and I think this is just the way I've always looked at things, is just that every person in this world has a story to tell from their own, because every experience and in perspective of this, even if you have the same event, everyone experiences that event differently. And how that event will then influence the individual moving past that also will be different. And so to me, every unique individual perspective is a unique story that you cannot really retell any other way except through the lens of the person who tells it. And so when you basically suffocate these kinds of stories or just ignore these kinds of stories, you are losing out on a piece of the human experience, and we just diminish because of that.
And also, we are diminished by the fact that we don't know those stories are there. You know, if we think that all that surrounds us is us, where is the evolution? Where is the, you know, mm-hmm. where's the richness to our lives? And it's the one thing that I just don't get. I mean, what do you do with your life when the only thing that you hear is the same thing over and over and over and over and over? How boring.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people that I can, there are some, I can understand that some people prefer to remain complacent with what they're familiar with. Because familiarity is breeds security. Mm-hmm. So people feel that, and that's probably why they latch on to those sort of feelings. But I mean, I will say that the answer, I guess, will always be dependent on the person who replies. How they reply when it comes to they don't think these stories matter, or they don't think these stories need to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that they realize that, you know, they have nothing to lose and a great deal to win by just looking around once or twice. That would be very nice indeed. Okay, let's head on to Unbreakable Revolution, because how long ago did this project start?
Exactly a year ago, because around this time 2020, myself, our editor-in-chief, Jazz, and our art director, Caroline, we were sitting in our meeting and we were trying to figure out what we wanted to do for the 2021 season. And I came up with this idea that we do something different, and which is funny when you think about the title. But I want to do something different. I didn't want to do just another just simple anthology. I wanted to do something woefully different, something that broke expectations, that didn't follow the status quo when it came to how you should write an RPG anthology. So I was like, let's do something different. Let's do the thing most people will never expect, and you know, which you don't see too many often people doing this, and which is curating a multi-system TTRPG anthology. So like every adventure is designed for either several rule sets or for one particular rule set, and we're going to curate them, and we want to centralize them around a theme, and we want to make sure that we have as much opportunity to let these creators have a space to do it and to really step forth and show what the versatility that Asian stories can tell.
Why did you decide to go on a multi-system instead of deciding, you know, let's go for the safe bit and let's do 5e, which would be, you know, incredibly popular because of 5e, mm-hmm. but why take the risk, in brackets risk, of going multi-system?
Well, so and that was so I think for me a lot of it came from the realization that yes, there is that element of safety for going 5e, and we still plan to do some 5e volumes because we have our first original product, which was a 5e product, and so we're going to continue that as well. But we decided, well, let's do new product lines and let's do something totally different. And I think for me, my feelings were at that time that we need to bring in new games, new ideas, new ways to tell stories, because there are other ways to tell stories, and the mainstream is the mainstream. People will always look to the mainstream, and it's always good to know that there are other things within its periphery, and all you have to do is just take a look around. And we're starting to see more people learning about other systems as we go. And so my hope is that having such a product is a opportunity for people who purchase it to try new systems, try new stories, and also see that there are other ways to tell stories through these different systems and that you can use them. And the other thing that we made that I was very strong about was making sure that these systems that we choose would be a curated list for our contributors to pull from, which would be having a free system reference document or free resource that people can just go on the internet, pull up the rules and have it available, because that's accessibility. Mm-hmm. That is a financial accessibility, because I don't know about anybody, but no one feels like spending, you know, $150 to $200 to just play a tabletop game. I don't know. That just feels like a lot of investment for the average consumer. And, you know, I would rather have it go, okay, well, you have the one book and you can, and we provide you how to acquire all the rule sets, and that's pretty much it. And so you only really spend for that one book to try almost a dozen different systems.
Hmm. How did you go about choosing the people who were going to work with you?
So we go through an open pitch process with our contributors. We also do a general public one. So we usually encourage for our contributors to be identify themselves as Asian. Mm-hmm. We don't strictly ask for any kind of pedigree or heritage. We just simply ask the simple question: do you identify as Asian, whether you're mixed or not? Do you identify as Asian? That is all I ask. And I still get a lot of emails when people say, I'm mixed. It's like, do you identify as Asian? This is the question I have to ask. This is all I need to ask. You need to answer me. And that is our basic requirement. And we don't really have a whole lot of, we're not really a big stickler about the experience level of our contributors, because this whole process is really about bringing in new voices to the space. And, you know, the thing is, like, that is the most important thing, is that they will learn through the editorial process. They'll learn through our feedback. They'll learn through, you know, even some of them will do playtesting, and they get to learn about how they write, how it translates when it comes to their playtesting. But yeah, so myself, Jazz, and Caroline, it's just the three of us. We review every pitch. We go through them one by one. So it's a very lengthy Sunday afternoon for us when we go through those. And so we go through all of them together. I think when we did 2021's entire pitch year, so it was for four book products coming up, I think we went through about 60 pitches.
That's a lot.
Yes. Yes, it was. And we ended up with this, and they were for everything. So it was like for Revolution, it's for our upcoming pathways. It's also for our 5e products. So, you know, we had to go through all of them, but for Revolution, we saw that there was a nice consistent list. And then there was a few people who were like skidding around the system agnostic kind of writing. So we said, okay, well, we approached them and asked them whether or not they could, if they would be comfortable doing it, because this is all about their comfort level as well. So they said yes. And so that's how we ended up with our final list for Revolution. We ended up having a few. So I will say, for the most part, when we looked at it and then we looked at the themes and we curated the themes, we just said, okay, so this is going to be Revolution. This is because this has all the storytelling that we want. And through that whole process, we will go through basically organizing our writers and scheduling our editors and having our art direction get done. And for the most part, it went through pretty well.
That's a question for you. I have is, how knowledgeable are you with all the systems? And with you, I mean, you're the team, because having, the reason I ask is because having many different systems, how could you ensure that the quality of the adventure and the applied mechanics and mechanisms was going to be there for the people to play?
So we definitely curated a list of system reference documents that would be applicable. And it's still a very long list, mind you. It's about 20 to 30 systems in there. And I personally had to read through all of them to make sure that they didn't have elements of cultural exploitation, or were written by problematic creators, or had a history. And then I even looked through the product history of some of these SRDs to see if there was a history of problematic creators using this and or problematic content that derived from it. And so I definitely spent a few months going through creating that list. And we still had it an open door policy where creators could still ask for us to write an adventure in a system that wasn't in the list. We would just have to review it. And that was all we had to do. So, being familiar with all of it, I will say it was a daunting task.
Well, I can imagine.
It was a very daunting task.
I can imagine, because that's a huge amount of work. Now, I am going to be incredibly cynical here. So I hope this comes as I intended to come through. But you said earlier that the only thing you ask is for people to identify as Asian. That is a very trusting policy, because I would feel that there could be some asshole out there saying, oh, this is unfair because it's just for Asian and not white people. So I'm just going to say that I'm Asian and present, you know, give them my pitch and my adventure, and hopefully they will publish me and I will say, ha-ha, I am not Asian, I fool you. Did you consider that could be a possibility at the time?
Oh, yes, I did, because in reality, that has happened in real life. Not with us, but I'll give an example. For those who don't know, the editor-in-chief at Marvel faked being Japanese to get his position. Because the position was designed to be, they were looking for specifically a BIMPOC person, and the person who's white actually falsified themselves and made themselves into they had a Japanese persona and a name and everything, and wrote things under that pen name, and then they submitted things, and when they got accepted, it was like a big surprise to everyone. And this editor-in-chief still continues to hope that nobody ever recounts this story, and I will continue to recount the story every time I get an opportunity to. So
wow, that is one big low.
Yeah, so I will say for us internally, we do try very hard to this is a good faith policy. Yes, you're right. It is a strictly a good faith policy. And we also have a lot of internal policies for if you violate the codes of conduct, because we also have a very strict codes of conduct regarding our creators, whether they be the writers, the editors, anybody in between. It even applies to me, so I am not immune to my own code of conduct. So we all must adhere to it, and if we're not, there's a lot of penalties involved. Besides the fact that your adventure will be pulled, besides that you'll lose out on all future revenue shares, we will make sure this is not pleasant for you.
No, that's indeed very, very fair enough. What are the basis of that code of conduct? Because I reckon that there might be some people interested in hearing out what is it that you do to ensure that safety.
So we definitely want to make sure that if you're, we definitely don't obviously want any racism. We don't want any bigotry. We're really the main things about that code of conduct that we really look out for are those sort of things. And then the other thing we always look out for is basically, I guess the best way to say would be like to incite violence. Like we're really not a fan of that. Even though we wrote an entire anthology about revolution, go figure. I will say for our internal code of conduct, that policy, we usually, when we wrote it, it was pretty much just to say, we don't want any fascists, we don't want any racism, we don't want any bigotry, and that basically we are to adhere to the fact that everyone here is to do the work of promoting Asian stories, and that this is not something to tear each other down about, and that pretty much obviously if you're the good faith policy isn't still, so if you are, so it's, that part isn't there, is there as well, and the part of basically you violating any of those kinds of parts of our codes of conduct, it will just basically be like I said, you lose out on future shares, you're removed from all the future printings, removed from the content, and you know, if we need to, we may even take legal action if necessary, depending on how severe the case is. That's usually it.
Did you have any case that you had to pull? You know, they said this is too much.
No, not yet.
Okay.
I'm very grateful to say not yet.
Well, that's actually pretty good because it means that the rules that you are putting out there are working. You know, people are reading it and actually at the very least making sure that they're adhering to it. That's great. It proves that codes of conduct work. Tell me about the authors. Who are they?
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't mean a list of one by one because people are going to be able to take a look at that in drive-through. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, where do they come from generally? What kind of surprises have you had?
So I think I'm very blessed to have someone like Pam, who wrote Make of Thee an Instrument of Peace. They wrote a adventure about Spanish colonial Philippines.
Ooh.
And what I really loved about that adventure is that the governor general is possessed by the demon, by a demon lord, by Beelzebul. And the players are actually playing part of a religious order who must infiltrate and enter into this into Spanish colonial Philippines during a very tantamounious time where, you know, civil war is happening and revolution is sparking. And so players will get to experience that the atmosphere of basically of Spanish colonial Philippines while in the cusp of a revolution from the local people. So that one, I love that one really, truly, dearly. And I will say I'm really blessed that what I really love too for our book is that we have two different Indian writers who come from two completely different regions of India. So you actually get two different perspectives of the Indian subcontinent, which is something that some people really aren't aware of, is that culturally speaking, in India, there are multiple different subcultures. There are many different cultures within India, and they're all uniquely different, and they all interpret things differently. They have different customs, different traditions, and even though most of them are Hindu, they also still have different perspectives of how of Hinduism. And you get to actually see and taste that both from in Unbreakable, because we have one from Rajiv, who did the Crimson Uprising, and then we have Charu, who did the first Dia of Navratri, and those are two different stories and two different parts of India, from like inspired by two different cultures of India, and I really love that a lot, and that is definitely something that I really enjoy that we managed to have in this book, the different perspectives, because some people don't know that. And it was really nice because we had somebody who's has an Indian background. They identified with that and realized that it's like it is two different. You actually got to represent both, like two different perspectives. And I'm like, yes, I'm so glad we could. And that is something that we don't artificially put into the anthologies. That is just something that we. That happens through the curation process. And I will say that, like, even in hindsight, I probably didn't. I will say that it's wonderful to be surprised from time to time when you can have something where it just fits and you're happy and you can be very happy to see the outcome of that.
I'm really, really pleased and happy to hear that there are some Indian writers in there as well, because I've always thought, I've been to India myself, and my niece is married to an Indian man, and she lived here for ages before going back to the UK. And when I visited India for her wedding, I was absolutely fascinated at the diversity within India, which is something that I wasn't expecting. You hear about India, and suddenly we all do what we do in Europe of, okay, one country, one people. And it's like, yeah, no, it really doesn't work like that. And I've always thought, yeah, there must be some amazing games and adventures and stories that can come out of here. I want to hear them. So knowing that there are two Indian writers there, that's fantastic. That's really great. What's been the hardest part of putting Unbreakable Revolution together?
The hardest part, the fact that it's myself, Jazz, and Caroline who have to do pretty much all of the organization.
Wow.
Because it's only three of us who are handling the art direction, so that includes the layouting. I am handling right now the business side of Unbreakable Publishers, so that is a different element. But I still do handle the creative management side of things. And then Jazz is the managing editor and our editor in chief overall. So Jazz actually has so basically it's a big handoff. So I make sure the writers get all their stuff together and then present that to Jazz. Jazz gets the editors together to get through the processes, then we go through sensitivity, and then we go through a revision, then another editing phase, and then we have Caroline who's doing layout the entire time. So it's a lot for three people to juggle at the same time, especially since for Jazz and Caroline especially, they both have full-time jobs, and I'm a full-time writer as well. So trying to juggle all of that as well has been an interesting time.
I bet it has. I mean, I've published a few books myself, just by myself, and I didn't write them. It was all translation work, or most of it, and it is a ginormous task. I don't think people understand how much work that goes into publishing a role-playing game or an adventure, really.
And the thing is, we do go through like that extensive, like there is that writing process, then we go through an editing process, then we go through a sensitivity reading process, and then through the sensitivity reading, the writers do another revision, which then the editor goes through with them one more time to clear before they can clear it for layout. And so that process in of itself could take at least 4 months, give or take.
That's quite some time.
Well, and we get, and the thing is too, we also try to be lax about the, about, well, I wouldn't say we were lax, but rather we give very healthy amounts of time to our creators. Granted, we've had a few moments where we've had to go like, this took a little longer. Can you push this along a bit for us? But overall, we try not to, especially myself and Caroline and Jazz, we didn't want to instill this notion of crunch, mm-hmm. which is a big industry concern that it, regardless of which industry you're in,
yeah.
of anywhere, crunch is a thing that everyone sometimes deals with. And we really didn't want our contributors to experience crunch. Ourselves, are the three of us, we can choose to experience crunch, but even then we really try to be gentle to ourselves and to our contributors that there is, that this is not how we don't want to be like everyone else in the industry. We want everyone to have a good experience and to have the ability to look back on their work and be proud of their work. And so that is why we take a longer approach than probably most publishing houses will ever take.
What are the advantages of that approach that you have experienced yourself? You know, the tangible things that you would say, this is the reason why I would recommend you do it this way.
I think for me, for example, I will say like for writers, like me personally, like we all go through different ups and downs in our lives. And creatively speaking, like there are high moments, there are low moments. And for a creator, you can't always be writing and creating 24/7, 7 days a week. It's just not going to happen. You will have some days that are better than others. And you know, that's probably when you should maximize it, is when you have those good moments, when you're in a good mental space to do it. But it may not happen for a while. We're also living in a time where people are going through large bouts of depression and, mm-hmm. and other things. And so it can be very difficult. And so the important thing I think I've ever stated that we wanted from this experience and from in general on Breakable is that, unlike, you know, we want to be understanding. We don't want to be like how in previous iterations of the industry where it always feels like this is an ironclad feeling where you're basically stuck. You've got to finish these things by the deadline or else. And I really was never for that. And so I really am grateful that for, you know, the last several years now, the industry as a whole has been moving into the mindset of, if you're thinking you're going to experience a delay, just message us so we can accommodate you and that we can accommodate our production schedule. And so for us, we do both. We give a little bit more time in most cases. And then we also understand and we try to keep an open door policy of like, hey, if there is something going wrong or if there's something that you need to talk to us about, we're here for you. We want to hear and we want to talk to you. So just feel free to message us. And in all honesty, that happens a lot. We get a lot of people messaging us like, hey, I'm not doing well. This stuff, you know, things are not coming through. And we're like, okay, that's not a problem. Just, you know, let's just amend the time and see if we can meet up this. If you can again, just let me know again. And then we'll just keep working at it until we get there.
That is also a big risk to take that approach, even though it's very, very gentle. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I think it's the right approach to take. But it's also a big risk because deadlines, which is a horrible word, but deadlines can indeed suffer.
Yeah.
Have you found that you could have published this sooner? Has it been worth it?
So I will say for us, we probably could have, we published Revolution in August. Our original plan was closer to May. So we were okay. 3 months delayed, but I will say for that part, that was not on the contributors. That was just mostly from myself, Jazz and Caroline being human beings as well, and having our own share of, needing to take care of ourselves. So I will say for the most part, when I think back to it, like we really could have probably gotten it done around May or June and probably been good. But I think it's more important that we both that everyone, including the three people who run everything, to take care of themselves as well. And so, yes, it's a risk. But I feel that in the long run, it's better for the longevity of not only just the the industry, but also the people who work in it, because we need people to have the ability to give themselves that kind of allowance. And I feel that, you know, that is something that I hope continues to be a thing that people ask for when they need it. And so, and for the most part, when I think back to Revolution, we've only had maybe one or two ish incidents where we have asked for an extension, which honestly is not really bad, all things considered, because we even factor in the extensions. So realistically speaking, we did pretty much meet our target timeline.
Well, I think that our 3 months delay is kind of next to nothing, especially if the effort of bringing it on time could have delayed the next project by 6 months because of the extra time you would need to recover after all the stress of bringing this on time in brackets. So I think 3 months is actually not bad at all. That's
yeah, it really wasn't. And I mean, I think the important lesson that we've learned is that, you know, we just make sure that when we, especially for the administration, myself, Jazz, and Caroline, is that we are communicating that suffering through blockers, or we're having issues we can't get past an obstacle or something like that, we work it together and something like that. So pretty much, I think, from both an industry standpoint and from our experience with Unbreakable, it's always been about communication. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing, is that we communicate when things are not going well or when things are happening, because on occasion, I still would send out, for the most part, updates to our contributors when they didn't hear back, especially if they didn't hear from me for a month or two. I'll be like, hey, here's where we are situationally, so that they are aware, and things like that. And whenever we meet accolades or updates, I usually send an email as well, because I would like everyone to be, you know, up to date and involved with their own success as well. So that's what I usually do.
No, that's fair enough indeed. I need to ask you this, but how was this funded? Did you go to any crowdfunding, or did this come out of your own pockets?
So for the most part, Unbreakable right now is not crowdfunded. That is something that we're looking to do in the future, because we want to equitably pay all of our creators. Right now, we are going through a royalty share split system for our contributors, but our goal moving forward is to eventually get to getting crowdfunding and having payout, and so we can pay our contributors for the work up front, and also they can have royalties at the end as well, because that in and of itself is also a financially liberating experience, because I live on passive income for all my royalties, and so my goal is to give the same opportunities to our creators and contributors, the ability to have passive income if they so choose to keep it. And so right now, for Revolution, it was strictly just mostly done from our own pockets, and then we're doing royalty split as for our compensation to our contributors right now.
That is a bit risk and a big amount of money, because producing a book is never a cheap endeavor. And I know that you must have a good reason. Why didn't you go for crowdfunding in the first place? Because I reckon this in Kickstarter would have done very well.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it had to do with, because we have, at that time, we had not formally established the business yet. Okay. So we were more, because when we, at the time when we first released Unbreakable Volume 1, the 5e anthology, we were still mostly, it was mostly a community effort more than actually us trying to create a publishing effort. And so by the time we were moving into Revolution, into these future books, it was definitely becoming something that we wanted to do long term, and we really didn't want it to just be a one and done experience. So this was a decision that was made for us to keep it going, and so we're moving it into that phase now. But for the most part, Revolution and Pathways, they will not be crowdfunded because of the structure that was before them.
Then why are you doing this? Because Obviously, it's not for the money. You know, this is not something that you're going to be making a ton of money. Why are you doing this huge amount of work? It's quite the task.
It's quite the task. And honestly, a lot of it has to do with the fact that, one, I want to prove the industry wrong in the sense that that these stories can exist and should exist and should have a space for them. Two, I also believe, in spite of the industry, that there can be more Asian creators in terms of writers, editors, artists, sensitivity consultants. I want more of them out there. I want more of them to have opportunities. I want more of them to be published. I want more of them to have opportunities that I probably would only dream of getting. I want them to succeed, in other words. And I really believe that, to the point where when we started doing this, I don't even think we were thinking too much about the high ceiling of profit or anything like that. We weren't even thinking about the profitability of it. We were really doing it for the sake of what is the most important thing, which was for the community as a whole.
The one thing as well that I wanted to ask you, because I can understand completely you wanting to have to see all those things. I think it makes, as far as I'm concerned, perfect sense. What would you tell companies out there? Because I still see an awful lot of work coming out with Asian background, but no Asian people working on them, or very, very few. What would you say to people who want to, because I can understand being enamored of all the cultures, it happens, it's a beautiful thing. Uh-huh. But what would you say to those companies who want to write things about Japan or the Philippines or China or anywhere else?
So my favorite argument I used to hear before was, like, probably back in 2014 and 2015, was definitely when people said that they didn't know anybody. That was the most common excuse I ever heard. They didn't know anybody. Well, and that's why this platform exists, because I want to be able to flood the space with more Asian creators, so I can basically gesture to the community and say, there are plenty of Asian creators here. I don't know what your problem is. I don't know what your problem is. You're saying there's not enough people to hire? Excuse me?
here are 50. Go for it.
There are 50. There's 100. Yes. And, you know, I am very blessed, because every time I see it, whether it be a friend of our contributor community or another Asian creator, or even just like someone in our community who actually gets an opportunity, I try very hard to make sure that if I find out about it, that I really try to shout it to the ceiling, to the heavens, to the sky about it, and try to share as much as I can on Twitter about it, because, you know, those are opportunities. Mm-hmm. And that's important, because that shows to people, look, these are people with credentials. You have no excuse to say anything about their qualifications, their ability, or the fact that they may be geographically in a difficult place. Because there are people who are becoming very successful in the TTRPG space, who are in countries not in the United States, who are not in Europe. And because we live in the advent of the internet, and, you know, we have things like video conferencing, we have emails, which has been around for over, you know, since the early 2000, you know, the 2000s and before that. So, like, we really have no excuse at this point of, like, really not having the ability to connect. And so I feel at that point, like, now we're trying to, so our main focus, at least for me, is to make sure that the classic argument of, I don't know anybody. Well, there's plenty here. Please pick.
You know, the thing about the, when people say I don't know anybody, it's a bit like, what is it again? May I introduce you to Google?
Yes.
Come on, get real. I mean, and the thing I find particularly offensive when people say, oh, I don't know anybody, is I'll be like, wait a second, do you really think that people are not writing games and adventures in Asia already? Seriously? Mm-hmm. Because that's erasing every single author who's writing stuff, and there is a lot of stuff being written. So it's
I will say personally that the amount of work that the RPGC community has churned out in the last 5 years is staggering, from their many successful Kickstarters to the fact that many of the creators in there have gotten to, you know, work with great opportunities and publishers. And, you know, I will say that for the fact that people would have the notion or gumption to say that that these stories don't need to exist, or the fact that, you know, they don't know anybody, or that they don't feel like they know where to look. I'm like, they're all right there. My personal other favorite is that there's even a website that an RPGC creator made to literally curate and organize every indie TTRPG made by an Asian creator.
So yeah.
So there's no excuse.
No, that completely blows that one out of the window right away. But I can imagine there must be still an awful lot of Asian creators out there who wouldn't know where to go or where to start. What would you tell them?
So I would tell them so I can definitely say we definitely live in a different, I will say, compared to when I started playing TTRPGs back in the early in around 2000, and looking now, like, the opportunity to create is really bountiful for a prospective writer. You can definitely get away with self-publishing on like platforms like Itch or DryThru or other places. And the thing is, people are sometimes, when they come in, they're generally afraid because they don't know about, like, you know, what's the standards, what are the expectations, like. And I will say that for the most part, I would say that there are a lot of creators who've taken the courage to say, I don't like the standard. I'm going to do it my way, and I'm going to make it as pleasing as it can be for myself. And I think that's the important thing, is that if you don't know where to start, you can start by just creating and working at it. And, you know, the other big thing, you know, is to look at when there are and look within the community, especially the TTRPG community. There's, you know, there are plenty of creators who can recommend each other to other different things, and you will find them eventually. It may take a little bit, but you will find them. And I would say, but the most important thing is to get started and just create, because you get better as you create. The more you create, the better you become, because you refine your craft. You then start seeing, you know, what you can improve, what needs to change. And you know, another great place to look is, and if you happen to stumble upon us in Unbreakable and want to take an opportunity with us when we have an open call, we welcome you. We really do. And, you know, that is definitely one place to look. And there are other opportunities, and because there are like workshops and things like that. Like Magpie does once in a while a creator's writer's workshop. And Storytellers Collaborative does one as well. And so, like, there are places to look. I mean, they might need some digging, but those are like the best places to look for. But yeah, my advice is to start, just to start. Don't pay attention to what other people say is the standard. Do it the way you want it to do it.
That's sound advice indeed. To wrap up the interview, and now what? What's next?
So we are working very diligently on Unbreakable Pathways, which is the next is another iteration. It's like Revolution. It's going to be a multi TTRPG anthology, but the stories for Pathways are centered around things like family, traveling, and food. So we really wanted to showcase things about the especially for a lot of Asian cultures, family is such a big integral element of their stories and of their identity, and so we really wanted to have kind of a story that's set around those kinds of experiences. And we also love the notion of like either stories about traveling. I think there's like one. And we definitely wanted to highlight the food because I feel like it's not just Asian. It's not definitely not just Asian cultures, but I feel like compared to some Western countries, it feels like food culture just somehow gets lost in translation. Mm. And we all forget about the heritage of our food cultures. Like we forget like what it took to get to this point of why we have these dishes. Why are these so important to us? What's the story behind the dishes? I think that's the thing that we're trying to highlight about the food element is like the foods that matter to us. Why do they matter to us?
That's quite interesting and absolutely beautiful. And I would really love to talk to you about that at some point in the future. I hope that comes out really quickly because that sounds fascinating. Jackie, thank you so much for being with me today. It's been truly fantastic, and I hope that we can repeat this again very, very soon.
Yes, I hope so too. Thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. It is truly wonderful to have you there and genuinely, genuinely appreciate it. The GMS Magazine podcast is produced by Paco Garcia with assistance from Chris Diaz and Martin Reed and the amazing bunch of listeners all over the world. That would be you. The theme tune is by Kev Adset. Please, please, please let me know what you think about the podcast by emailing me at podcast@gmsmagazine.com or get in touch in our Facebook page or the Discord channel. And do join me in Twitter. I am at GMS Magazine and I would love to hear from you. But until the next time, thank you once again for being there and game on.